Welcome everyone to this week's Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar programs of CCLs that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics related to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is going to dive into explaining budget reconciliation, at least as best as we can. And a quick qualification that this training will probably be soon outdated. So if you're listening 2 or 3 weeks after our live session, there's probably some more recent material out there. So just be forewarned for those that are tuning in later. But this training is going to review what the congressional process of budget reconciliation is and how it might apply to a carbon fee and other climate legislation currently under consideration. To get us there, what we're going to do tonight is have the chance to hear from our very own strategy director. Tony Cerna drives CCL's organization-wide strategic thinking. He supports our long-range planning, helping clarify organization priorities and maximize our effectiveness at achieving them. Tony also helps coordinate immediate efforts to achieve strategic goals, promoting synergies across departments and providing accountability for those goals. So you can imagine this is a pretty apt topic for Tony to really take charge and help us all walk through. And if we've done our job well, at the end of our hour together, we're really hoping to achieve the following 3 learning goals: the chance to highlight the basics of the congressional process of budget reconciliation and really distinguishing it from the budget resolution as well. We'll also understand how this process might apply to carbon fee and dividend related legislation. And then Tony's going to do a great job in reviewing how additional climate legislation relates to the budget reconciliation process, both what's been proposed as well as what we might anticipate. And so to get us there, what we're going to do is focus first on background, then dive in a bit deeper about reconciliation to budget resolution. Tony's then going to review carbon fee and dividend, how that all fits in before pivoting to other climate policies and discussion, and really focusing on some recent studies and what they've found. And then we'll open up for Q&A probably about halfway through for the second half. So again, if you're just tuning in, feel free to start putting those questions that you have for Tony in the chat. And with that, the floor is yours, Tony. Thank you so much for being here tonight, everyone. And we look forward to a great training.
Great. Thank you, Brett. It's great to be here. I've been giving some talks this week to our state coordinators and to our strategic planning action team. And so it's great to be on the CCU and talk about reconciliation, because that is what is on everyone's mind right now. First question is, what is budget reconciliation? Why are we even doing this? Budget reconciliation is a process that allows specific budget-related legislation to bypass the filibuster in the Senate, so it can pass with just 51 votes. Now, technically, the budget reconciliation process also happens in the House of Representatives, but it doesn't really change the dynamics there, so it's not as important that House aspect of things. But in both chambers, they're going to pass a budget bill. They're going to then they have to end up passing exactly the same budget bill for it to become law. And that's how, you know, we, you know, achieve sort of the end goal of the budget for the year. So what this whole 60 vote versus 51 votes, what does that even mean? So in the Senate, there's nothing in the Constitution that says this is the case, but the way it's been working is that you essentially need 60 votes to pass legislation. And that is because technically you need 60 votes to end conversation on a topic. So at this point, it takes 60 senators to be able to end that conversation. And that's what's called a vote for cloture, which, and when you prevent a cloture vote, it's called a filibuster. So you'll hear people talk about the filibuster or filibuster reform, and that's what they're talking about. And so the budget reconciliation process is designed to bypass the filibuster because it does not require a cloture vote. It does not require 60 votes to pass. It only requires a simple majority, which in the Senate means 51 votes. And currently, the majority party, the Democrats, have 50 senators plus the vice president to be the tiebreaker and be that 51st vote. And you can go on to the next slide. So the budget reconciliation process, you can get out into the weeds. Like, technically it can be used more than once per year, but only if you did separate parts, like one for spending and one for, revenue generation and one for something else. But in practice, it's generally used once per fiscal year. Now, there was one earlier this year, this calendar year, which was for the COVID relief package. And that was technically for the fiscal year 2021. Now, the current reconciliation debate is going on for the fiscal year 2022 budget reconciliation. So they'll do that. And that would mean, you know, they wouldn't be able to do another one until a year, you know, essentially a year from now until the 2023 budget. So it's generally just once per fiscal year. And there's a question of like, what can be included in a budget reconciliation? So it has, one, it has to be about budgets. And so there's a set of procedural rules that people call the bird rule, or when they're being clever, they call it the bird bath. And so the bird rules, named after a Senator Byrd, they try to exclude anything that would not produce a change in the budget in either outlays or revenue. It's not allowed to make changes to Social Security, and it's not allowed to increase the deficit beyond 10 years. And so remember that 10 years, because that's an important piece. And also remember the deficit piece of that. When we get to the talk about carbon pricing, I'll just say it now so I don't have to remember. It means that because a carbon price would increase revenue and not add to the deficit, it actually can go beyond 10 years. So that's an interesting nuance in that 10-year timeline. So when people talk about something being germane to the budget, or so there's a question of what can't you do in the budget? So you can't, you couldn't just change, you know, Voting Rights Act. You couldn't, pass something to change war powers, or, authorization of force, So there's a bunch of things that are not budget related. And one of the things you can't do is you can't just pass a straight up regulation. So you can't pass a clean electricity standard. You can't, whatever, there's lots of regulations. You can't change the Clean Air Act, but you can do budget related things that mimic some of those regulations. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. So we can go on to the next slide. So how is the Byrd rule enforced? So in the Senate, the technical way is that any senator, once the legislation is on the floor, any senator can object to a piece of the reconciliation bill and say, I think line 7043 is out of order and does not, relate to the budget. And the parliamentarian, the Senate parliamentarian, can make a decision of whether that complies with the Senate's rules. And so that's the point when it officially happens. But what happens behind the scenes is that while the legislation is being crafted, the senators talk to the parliamentarian's office and they say, do you think this, is compliant with the Byrd rule? Do you think this would work? Is that, we want to achieve this goal. Does this wording work? Does that wording work, et cetera? So they're behind the scenes, they're working on that to try and make sure that the legislation is compliant before it ever is brought to the floor. But you can rest assured that if there's something that could be objected to, that there'll be some senator who's generally opposing the reconciliation package, so likely a Republican senator, could call out any piece of the legislation and, call for a ruling from the parliamentarian. Now, technically, the leader of the Senate, or maybe it's the vice president in this case who presides over the Senate, could overrule the parliamentarian. But in practice, this has not been done in the past. This would be a major shift in Senate norms and would just cause a major freak out in the Senate, and everyone would be really upset. Now, I can say that there was a time in the past when the senators did not like how the parliamentarian was ruling on things, and they fired them. And so it's not that this has never been done, or that there have never been ways that the parliamentarian's been will has been subverted, but in general, when the parliamentarian says this is not allowed, the senators have gone along with that. Okay. And so what is the budget resolution? So a few weeks ago, we already saw the budget resolution passed both the Senate and the House. And in the budget resolution, that's basically directions from the budget committee to each of the other committees. So in the, in the House or in the Senate, you have like Energy and Natural Resources and the Finance Committee, and you have the committees on, health and the, et cetera, veterans and, armed services, those kinds of committees. And each of them is given instructions, but they're very simple instructions. They're very terse. All they say is, the such and such committee can, you know, increase spending by $100 billion. The such and such committee must reduce spending by, you know, $500 billion. You know, the finance committee should, you know, increase revenue by at least this amount. So it doesn't get into the details of, you know, it shall be done this way and da 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 da. That's up to the committees. So what that does is it sets sort of a top line figure for what they're expecting the scope of the budget resolution of the budget reconciliation process to include, but it doesn't set the details of it. Now, around that same time, we were starting to see sort of fact sheets and bullet point lists of what was expected to be in there, and the numbers reflected some of those things. So at that time, we were starting to hear people say, like, the Senate's agreed that such and such will be in the budget reconciliation. And all that means is there was enough money for it, and that's sort of what everyone's expecting to happen. Now, again, even those budget resolution instructions are not binding. It doesn't mean that the Senate has or the House has agreed definitely to spend that much money on each committee, because, you know, once those committees come back with their details, they could bring back something that's lower or higher. The whole chamber could decide to change it. You know, there's been a lot of talk that some of the senators are not comfortable with a $3.5 trillion spending amount, and they might want to scale that back. So even though there's been an agreement to in the budget resolution to that spending amount, it's not set in stone. They've not committed to it, and all of that can be changed. But it does give a sense of what direction they're going. So next slide. So how might a carbon fee and dividend fit into reconciliation? So in some ways, carbon fee and dividend is, you know, sort of the perfect fit for the budget reconciliation package. The carbon fee affects revenue in a non-incidental way, so it's definitely germane to the budget. It's in fact a very big revenue raiser. Even a modest carbon fee can raise, you know, $500 billion over 10 years or $1 trillion over 10 years if it escalates quickly. Also, a carbon dividend is, you know, affects revenue, or actually affects spending in a non-incidental way, or if you, you know, frame it as a refundable tax credit or something like that, then, you know, it's then technically you're affecting revenue. And then a border adjustment, which is the other, you know, one of the other key pillars of a carbon fee and dividend, also affects revenue. If we're charging money at the border for any imports, you know, based on their carbon content, then that also generates revenue for the country and would actually be a net income source given the balance of trade that we have in this country. So all three of those components can fit in there. One thing I do want to mention, you know, people sometimes ask, well, if it's totally revenue neutral, you know, can that fit into budget reconciliation? And my sense is that it can, because the carbon fee and the dividend are actually separate measures. And so the one thing you probably couldn't do in a budget reconciliation process that you did see in like the Energy Innovation Act is, in the Energy Innovation Act, it says all the money from the carbon fee would go directly into like a carbon dividend trust fund. And then all that money would go back out. So you probably couldn't set it up so that it was that tightly coupled. But you could still say, you know, we're gonna collect, you know, this amount of, we're gonna set this carbon fee. And we're gonna give people this money. And it's like, are those like intimately tied? Are you giving them exactly the amount that was collected with the carbon fee? You probably can't do that, but you can give people an equivalent rebate to make sure that they're kept whole. Okay, so maybe I already mentioned this. So many provisions that are passed through budget reconciliation expire after 10 years because they would increase the deficit beyond that threshold. So anything that's a major spending thing, but even some of the tax cuts. So this is why you've seen over the last, many years, all these situations where it's like, oh, the Bush tax cuts are about to expire. And so da 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 da, or like that tax, you know, rebate is about to expire. And it's like a lot of these things are about to expire because they were passed through reconciliation. And so they could only be passed for a certain amount of time, or because they didn't want to exceed a certain threshold of spending or something like that. So that's something to look at most of the things. But again, a carbon fee, as long as it, so you might not be able to have the dividend go beyond 10 years, but you could definitely have the carbon fee go beyond it. Or if it's paired with the dividend in such a way, but that it still generates some net revenue and does not increase the deficit, then the two could continue beyond if it's carefully written that way. And that's also true of the border carbon adjustment. Again, because I assume that that would generate revenue given our imports. Okay. So what might need to be different if you wanted to see a carbon fee and dividend in reconciliation? Basically, you would need to have at least some increase or decrease of outlay. So it couldn't be intimately tied, as I said. You'd have to see, you probably wouldn't be able to set up new programs. So you couldn't set up the Carbon Dividend Trust Fund. You couldn't do any of the, like if you looked at the Energy Innovation Act, there were also things in there that it set up a study and it set up a review of this. And it talked about, in one version, there was a pause on Clean Air Act rulings. Like none of that can go into budget reconciliation, in the same way. So, there's limited ability to set up new programs. Is there a third one there, Brett? Yeah, no regulatory provisions. So all the pieces about regulatory pauses or other regulations in there, or also the piece in one of the versions of, the Energy Innovation Act, there was also an increase in the regulatory, after the pause there was, and the EPA shall have to meet these targets. You also can't do that under budget reconciliation as well. So let's look at what other climate policies we might be looking at in reconciliation, and then we'll get to what's happening right now. So again, as I mentioned, you can't do regulation, you can't do bans, you can't affect the Clean Air Act. It's hard to do specific standards, but it's up to the Senate parliamentarian exactly what can be part of that. We're not going to be banning fossil fuel infrastructure. You're not going to be banning the sale of, emitting vehicles, but you can provide tax incentives for non-emitting vehicles. So we'll see that as an example. As we look at towards the reconciliation, we should definitely expect to see, investments in research and development, tax credits for, extending, solar, et cetera, other tax rebates or credits. There's a green bank that we're talking about. So targeted loan programs for clean energy businesses. There's also, talk of funding for environmental justice loans and support. A lot of the spending on sort of infrastructure, some of that has gone through the bipartisan infrastructure deal that also that passed the Senate earlier this year and it's expected to be voted on September 27th. But there's also a bunch of non-climate related infrastructure as well as climate related infrastructure that we're expecting to see in the reconciliation package. And then also they can change some of the subsidies for fossil fuels. So, right now they're talking about ending certain energy subsidies. And so that would be that totally, because that changes revenue, that can totally be part of the budget reconciliation. And then also, this is a great place, we can definitely spend money to support, workers and communities that are transitioning from fossil fuels. Okay, so in this reconciliation package, what are they talking about? What has already been approved by the House? So in this last week or so, the House has various committees in the House, the Ways and Means Committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee, et cetera, have submitted their draft legislation. They've gone through what they call committee markup. And that material, that legislation is then going to go get consolidated by the Budget Committee and go through the House's process to get voted on. There's a good chance that's going to get voted on before September 27th. So that because Nancy Pelosi made a promise to certain House moderates that the bipartisan infrastructure package would get voted on by the 27th, and made promises to the progressives that the budget reconciliation would get voted on before the infrastructure package. So hopefully both of those will get voted on by then. But one of the things to remember is that the rubber really meets the road in the Senate here. And so while I'm going to describe what's going on in the House, we have to remember that all of that could get changed once it goes to the Senate. So currently coming from the House, there's a Clean Electricity Performance Program, which provides incentives for utilities to sell ever greater portion of clean energy. Right now, there's strong incentives for 4 percentage points increase per year. So if you're a utility and currently you're selling 40% clean energy, then this program would encourage you to go to 44 next year and 48 the year after that, 52 the year after that, or at least that fast. And it does that by providing a grant based on the number of megawatt hours sold that are clean energy if you meet that target. And then if you don't meet that target, it provides for a penalty that each of those utilities would pay if they're not meeting their clean energy targets. There's also extensions of the tax credits for wind and solar. And those extensions include conversion to direct pay. Like right now, when you get one of these tax credits, it's a tax credit. So you save on future taxes. And the way that that ends up working for the utility or for the companies that are installing clean energy is that they have to get someone else to loan them the money on the notion that they will get paid back later based on these tax credits. But by making it direct pay, then they don't have to take a loan, and then therefore they don't have to pay interest on that. And so more of the money can go directly to those people who are installing clean energy rather than those people who are just lending money. So this is actually a great win for the renewable energy providers. There's also tax credits, and these are new for energy storage systems. So grid scale batteries, et cetera, as well as transmission lines, because all the models show that we would do much better at providing a cleaner grid if we can increase the amount of transmission so that different regions can share power more effectively. And there's also tax credits in there to support existing nuclear power. They don't apply to new nuclear facilities, but they do provide credits for existing nuclear power so that to keep nuclear power plants from shutting down while we're in this transition. There's also tax credits for manufacturing. So not just for the people who are installing new capacity for wind and solar, but also the people who are setting up manufacturing facilities. So that is an attempt to try and bring some of that clean tech manufacturing back into the US. A lot of it is happening overseas. And so this is an attempt to subsidize and encourage that to be happening on our shores. And then there's also an extension of the carbon capture, utilization, and storage credit that I think is a pretty similar extension. There's a few changes to that, some of which people are excited about, some people are complaining about. Sort of depends on your point of view. I won't go into the details there. Okay, on to the, I think, is it buildings next? Or yeah, buildings. Okay, so in the building sector, I will say there's not as much as there is in the electricity sector, but there is some money for energy efficiency retrofits. So this is like, you know, weatherizing, you know, insulation, otherwise, new windows, those kinds of things. And I think that's both for residential and commercial. Then there's building electrification. So if we are going to solve climate change, we probably need to shift a lot of gas heating and water heaters and cooking and dryers and all those kinds of appliances so that they are electrified. And so there is money to install heat pumps, heat pump water heaters, and otherwise shift from gas appliances to electric appliances, which goes hand in hand with decarbonizing the electric grid. There's also money in there for decarbonizing federal buildings, which is a great way to, jumpstart the industry for, building decarbonization. And then under transportation, there's a number of subsidies. One, they would extend and expand the electric vehicle subsidy. So that includes for new vehicles. It changes some of it. There used to be limits on how much any given manufacturer, how much subsidies they could be given out for their vehicles, but it expands that. It makes some requirements based on where the vehicles are manufactured and what kind of worker arrangements they have in terms of unionization. And then there's also subsidies for used electric vehicles, which really can help people of lower income who aren't the type who buy new cars. And also the EV subsidies are also direct pay. So you do not have to, right now, it's hard to take advantage of them if you don't have a significant tax liability. A lot of lower income households don't actually pay enough taxes to really be able to take advantage of the electric vehicle subsidy. But both for new and used vehicles, those subsidies would be refundable. There's also electric bicycle subsidies. So if you if you prefer not to have a car and you want to have an electric bike, you can get a subsidy for those as well. And then there's also funding for electric vehicle charging infrastructure. So there's sort of a chicken or egg problem with electric vehicles, in that, you know, there's some notion if we get enough people buying them, then the charging infrastructure will get built, but people won't buy them until you build enough charging infrastructure. And so this this program built, you know, calls for funding for both of those sides of that coin. And then there's also funding for municipal heavy-duty electric vehicles, so buses, fire trucks, et cetera. I don't think there's funding for like long-haul trucks or something, but I haven't seen that yet. And then there is money for decarbonizing the federal vehicle fleet, which has been talked about, and aviation fuel credits. So that's mostly goes to things like biofuels that are used for air flight. Okay, and then there's the sort of taxes and financing. And so again, we're talking about the House here. So there is elimination of some fossil fuel subsidies, but not all of the ones that activists have been calling for. There's a green bank to finance low emissions and technical deployment. So not necessarily, you know, research, but it's about, you know, this technology is available. We want to, you know, deploy it further. And, you know, how do we do that? So they've got some financing available for that. And there's also a specific fund for environmental justice related projects and for local small scale solar. So both of those are available as grant programs and loan programs, I think both. And then there's a whole bunch of other there are things that don't necessarily fit into these categories. So methane pricing, something that you know, CCL is excited to see because it's a market-based price on greenhouse gas emissions. I haven't been able to find the time yet to dig into the details of it, but there is pricing in the House version that is based on methane leaked from fossil fuel extraction, processing, and transportation. It's different than what than any of the legislation that's already been submitted to Congress. There was a Deutsch bill in the House, and there's a Sheldon Whitehouse has a bill in the Senate, and the House's version is different. And I haven't had a chance to read the details. So hopefully we won't have any detailed questions on that, because I don't know the answers yet. But we will know soon. We're gonna do some research on that. And we'll also have to see what the Senate comes back at. And then there is a clean hydrogen tax credit. So this is for any hydrogen that's produced that's at a much lower emissions level than the sort of the standard process is you actually take natural gas and you do something with steam to drive out to end up with hydrogen. But if you want to produce hydrogen in a zero emissions way from, you know, electrolysis, you know, using electricity to generate it from water or some other system, that's it's got to be a certain target below the standard process to get that tax credit. So I think that's everything. Oh, one more thing. The Civilian Conservation Corps, this is something that a lot of groups on the left have been advocating for, and this would provide funding for something, you know, akin to the Depression era, you know, Conservation Corps that would take the, you know, for specific jobs related to climate, and it would provide funding to bring young people into those industries. But of course, as I said earlier, it's really the Senate is going to be, you know, have a much more weight in terms of the debate between those chambers because of the tightness of the margin there, and also because of the Byrd rule and all that. So what are we expecting from the Senate? Well, as probably all of you have been hearing, we're expecting that there's carbon pricing with a dividend or a rebate. We're seeing a lot of noise on that in the press just today. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal. There was an article in E&E News. We've seen it in, you know, Bloomberg and on NBC, et cetera. So the Senate Finance Committee is definitely talking about this as one of the tax changes that they're considering. We don't have a lot of details on that yet, but the news that we've seen says $15 per ton to start, escalating, but it doesn't say at what rate. And then it says with a rebate to low and middle income households. So that does sound like there'd be a rebate. There'd probably be some amount of means testing. So it wouldn't necessarily be an equal dividend to every single household. And then it also says that would include a border carbon adjustment. So that sounds a lot like carbon fee and dividend, not exactly carbon fee and dividend, but it does include both a rebate and a border carbon adjustment. Now, is this for certain? No, it's not for certain yet. You know, we still need to, the, you know, Finance Committee has not released its draft legislation. That's why we continue to be calling, you know, to writing our senators, writing, you know, the president, to make sure that they know that there is strong support for carbon pricing. And you're starting to see a lot of other organizations, now that they see that this is, you know, coming to fruition, a lot of other organizations are starting to, you know, put out articles and op-eds, et cetera, in support of a carbon price and reconciliation. So I also mentioned that, you know, there was the, in the House version, there's extensions to the solar and wind and other renewable energy tax credits. And they're talking about something similar in the Senate, but they're talking about doing it in a different way. Senator Wyden, who's the head of the Finance Committee, he's got a different plan to basically like get rid of all the energy, existing energy subsidies, and replace them with three subsidies that are based on emissions reductions. So there'd be one for like power, one for transportation, and one for buildings or something like that. And it would basically be based on how much emissions are you reducing. And so this would replace all the existing fossil fuel subsidies. It would replace the existing renewable energy subsidies, but it would basically be, I think, equivalently appealing to those renewable energy companies because of, you know, and sort of a one-to-one replacement for that. But it would extend to, you know, storage. It would extend to that. And so, like, I don't know the details. I haven't gotten into the weeds on the difference between those two policies, but that is something that's likely to be different between the Senate and the House. And then, as I mentioned, the methane pricing, I don't know whether the Senate will adopt what the House was talking about in terms of their methane pricing structure. I know that Senator Whitehouse's version is based on sort of a what they call per basin system. So like, you know, if you're drilling for natural gas in a certain area of the country, then you're gonna pay a fee based on sort of the average amount of methane leakage in that area. Whereas I think the House version maybe gets down into more specifics, you know, entity by entity. And then what else might be in there? Like, well, we don't know. The Senate Finance Committee actually listed a number of other potential. They talked about a virgin plastic tax. They talked about a per barrel oil of oil tax. They talked about taxes on specific industries. I don't know if we would see all of those or just, you know, one or more of those. We don't know yet. But there are other potential climate provisions that could come out of any of those committees. And also, there might be things that the Senate does not include that were included in the House. So for example, all of those, you know, the Clean Electricity Performance Program and other provisions related to that, those are going through the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which is headed by Joe Manchin, who has already stated some of his concerns about those policies and about a whole bunch of things related to the reconciliation package. So we definitely need to see the House's version as, you know, it's interesting, but it is not conclusive. And so, you know, we're on staff here at CCL, we are not worried that carbon pricing was not part of that. We feel like seeing this, what the Senate Finance Committee is talking about, we feel optimistic about that, but there's still a lot to be determined and a lot to be seen. And, you know, this process is really in some ways just beginning at this stage. So what level of emissions are we likely to see from these different different programs? So a few weeks ago, Chuck Schumer, majority leader in the Senate, released a chart and a statement to like what they call a Dear Colleague memo. So it was written to others in the Senate, and it gave a breakdown of some modeling that they've done. We don't know who did the modeling or what this is based on, but this is how the different parts of the package that they are looking at the time. And so this is very similar, very closely models what you see in the House, how much emissions reductions you'd see from those different programs. But the top line is, how do we get to 45%? Well, what that's referring to is 45% below 2005 levels in emissions. And the thing is, you know, Joe Biden promised that we were going to get to 50 to 52%. That's what he promised Americans. That's what he promised, you know, the people in the Paris Accord. And so there's a question of, well, 45 is less than 50. And so how are they going to get there? But this does give a breakdown of how much you can, you know, do some math from this to see how much emissions reductions people are expecting from these different programs that are expected in the reconciliation package or are already represented in the House version. So this chart does not include carbon pricing, but then there was a new study released just today from Resources for the Future, RFF, and they included a great chart, which we'll zoom in on just a second. And they did some modeling on both the clean energy performance program, the tax credits, and a carbon fee. So they said that if you had a carbon price that started at $15 per ton in 2023, rising to $30 in 2028, and then increasing at $10 per year through 2040, so they modeled that. I don't know exactly where they got that. Maybe they're in consultation with some folks in the Senate, or maybe they're just making stuff up. But they showed that the reductions in emissions, again, below 2005 levels, and that's what the target is for the Biden set, that if you just use the clean electricity payment program and the tax credits, you would only get to 39% below 2005 levels by 2030. The carbon fee alone could get you to 45%. Now, that they also modeled what would happen if you exempted consumer gasoline from that carbon fee. And I think the reason that they're looking at that is, politicians are often wary of raising prices of gasoline. It's something that consumers are very price sensitive to. And so, but what they found when they modeled exempting gasoline, that it only changed the overall emissions level to 44% instead of 45%. And some of that's because as we know, carbon fees are not as immediately effective on the transportation sector as other policies are. And so it would definitely change the amount of revenue that came from the carbon fee, but it would not necessarily make a huge change in emissions because of the sort of inelasticity of demand for gasoline and the fact that most of the reductions in the transportation sector are going to be driven by people either buying more efficient vehicles, switching to electric vehicles, et cetera. So then they modeled what happens if you throw all three together. If you got the whole package, then you get 52% emissions reductions. We love that number, 52%. That is, the target that, above the target that, the minimum of the target that Biden set. And that even if you had exempted gasoline, you would still get to 50%. Now, I don't know the details of this model. I don't know if it included any of the other provisions that they're talking about in the reconciliation. I think it just focuses on the CEPP and the tax credits and a carbon fee. So if there are other programs in there, then it would those would be additional emissions reductions on top of this based on their model. And I thought you might want to be able to zoom in on that graph. So you can see the top of that graph is the business as usual. If you want to see just the carbon pricing, you'll see the green line, the green and the orange line, solid lines. Those show you what the reductions we'd see from the carbon pricing. They also modeled a much lower carbon price of $15 per ton that only increased at 5% a year. That's the sort of purple line. And you can see that low carbon price, even by itself, is actually reduces emissions more than the tax credits and the clean electricity performance program. And then when you add all the different pieces together, there you get the orange and the green dotted line. And so those are when you add in the carbon price, the tax credits, and the clean electricity performance program all together with or without the gasoline exemption. And you can see how that makes, just not that much of a difference by 2030. It starts to make a little more difference as you get out to 2040. The carbon price starts having more effect on the transportation sector. So that is what I got right now. And now is the time for questions.
All right, so the first one here is from the very beginning. And the question really is clarifying, can you comment on the implications of linking the infrastructure bill to the reconciliation bill and how this might impact Republican support for either?
Sure, so for the last few months, they've been talking about this sort of two-track path where there was both a bipartisan infrastructure bill and the reconciliation bill. And then those have been sort of intimately tied in the House about that vote on September 27th. And the tricky thing is once the House passes the infrastructure bill, then I believe that it goes to to Biden to sign. And so then at that point, you know, while there was a commitment to vote for both of them, that leverage is then gone. And so then it becomes a question of, you know, just making sure that the Democrats can get their caucus together to vote for everything. So the two are tied right now, but if the infrastructure plan package passes, then that any tie was all just, you know, agreements between people and nothing is binding. There may be some trick up someone's sleeve to keep the two tied beyond that 27th, that vote on the 27th, but I am not aware of that or what that might look like.
Excellent. Joni wants to clarify, so can revenue neutral legislation be in a reconciliation package?
Again, I don't think it can be the same level of revenue neutrality that you see in the Energy Innovation Act, in the sense of that you can't put all the money into a trust fund, but I think you can have something that approximates revenue neutrality. Again, I don't know how they will structure that in terms of a rebate and whether it will rebate all or only a portion of the carbon fee that was collected. So I think you can do a form of revenue neutrality, but not a strict revenue neutrality.
Excellent. Have you heard, Tony, whether an item in budget reconciliation can be referred to only one committee?
Yeah, that's my sense, is that each section gets referred to one committee and then it comes back to the whole. So it's unlike something like the Energy Innovation Act was referred to multiple committees. So it would go through this, you know, it was supposed to go through Ways and Means and then Foreign Relations and, you know, et cetera. I don't think it has to do that. The budget reconciliation is sort of a fast track process.
All right, excellent. Ray's got a great question here clarifying about the Affordable Care Act. How did it fit under reconciliation rules as far as you understand, Tony, given that it had new policies and rules? And what lessons would we draw from the Affordable Care Act?
Okay, I don't remember the exact details, but my memory is that the Affordable Care Act, they had 60 Democrats in the Senate. They passed it through regular order, but then they messed something up and then they came back and they just made some modifications to it through reconciliation, so that the bulk of that policy was actually passed through regular order, and they couldn't finish it through regular order because Ted Kennedy died and they lost their 60th Democratic senator. So I don't remember all the details on that. And I also know that they made the House vote on exactly the same version of the Senate because they lost that 60th vote. So it was a little bit of a mess at the time, but I don't think the whole thing passed the reconciliation.
Great clarification. Here's one that I know a lot of climate activists have been concerned about. How has clean energy been defined in terms of the House package?
Yep. So in the Clean Energy Performance Program, clean energy is defined as anything that emits less than 0.1 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per megawatt hour. So coal power generally is in the like 0.8 range. Natural gas power is generally in the 0.4 range. And so to get below 0.1, you're talking nuclear, you're talking, you know, solar, wind, et cetera. Now, it does allow that if someone had a, you know, a natural gas plant and they installed a carbon capture system and it captured at least 75% of the emissions, that it could get below that emissions intensity. So I think it does allow for carbon capture and utilization and storage. It could allow for some other way to do that, something similar, like you could either mix hydrogen in with your natural gas, or you could be mixing some sort of renewable methane, or like, I don't know, but there's anything that could get your emissions intensity down below that 0.1 value. So I think for people who didn't want to see natural gas get credited as a clean energy, that is how it is worded right now. So you have to, unabated gas does not count as clean energy. You would have to do some sort of abatement or carbon capture or mixing it with other fuels.
Excellent. Thank you for clarifying that. Here's one that Lisa poses that I think a lot of people have been thinking about as well, which is just the incentive to transition or get credit for a 4% decarbonization for utilities seems to heavily favor those that have a lower percent mix of renewables currently, because it's clearly easier to decarbonize from 24 to 28 potentially than from 44 to 48. Have you heard discussion of how that is being treated kind of relative to the current mix that utilities have of renewables?
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to take this as a way to say, start where you are and improve from there. because utilities across the country are in very different situations. I mean, there's a lot of different types of utilities that have, you know, and lots of different state laws, et cetera. So I'm sure that there are complaints that people could have about, you know, that this doesn't support the early adopters or give them the kind of credit that that they deserve for things. It does say that if you get to, I think, 85%, then you no longer, there's no penalties above that. So they're not, if you're already, whenever you get to that level, there's no penalties. You don't have to increase further, but you can still get funding if you do increase further. One other thing, I mean, one other thing to consider is if you're like, if you're right now have only a very small amount of, you know, clean energy. And let's say you have, let's say you're the kind of vertically integrated utility, or even like a rural electric co-op where they have, like they own their own coal plant. And so maybe you're producing 0% clean energy. And, you know, there's this big discontinuity. It's like, how do you close down a coal plant? Like, you know, you've got to like, and replace all that electricity at the same time in a market where like, you know, and so like, there are some challenges. So like, I wanna, you know, there are some types of utilities, it's relatively easy for them to say like, oh, well, we'll just buy a little more clean energy each year. But then there's some that they own the infrastructure that generates that electricity. And so there's more discontinuities in the system. So there are, there's just a lot of different dynamics between a rural electric co-op, a municipal electricity, you know, municipal utilities, investor-owned, vertically integrated, reformed market where they're buying, you know, in a deregulated system. So it's a complex thing that I only feel like I scratched the surface on and can already see that it's super complex. So I'd say that that this is only one of the dynamics in there, and that I'm sure almost any utility could claim that they're getting the short end of the stick on this.
Thank you for those details.
Yeah.
Here's the next question. Is there anything in the House version or what you've seen so far in the draft or proposed legislation for the Senate that decarbonizes or has incentives for decarbonizing the military?
The only thing I can imagine is the federal fleet and the federal buildings. And I don't know if those apply to military bases or not, but in the past, I think some of the, sometimes they have. So I don't know the answer to that though.
Okay, great question. How about discussion about pricing air pollutants like in the Save Our Future Act?
I have not heard any discussion of that. And that would be, in my opinion, very interesting to see and great to see, but I have not seen that take off. And so as far as I know, I would be surprised to see that at this point.
All right, we're almost caught up and go to the phones here for our last 10 minutes. I have two questions left in the chat you haven't gotten to. Great work, Tony. One of which is, can you talk a little bit more about conference committee and how the Senate and House work together to create a final bill if there's differences?
Right. So the way that a legislation typically happens is, you know, one house will pass a version, the other house, you know, so the House might pass a version, the Senate would pass a version, and then they get together in a conference committee where they resolve the differences, they find something they think is going to be mutually agreeable, and then that goes back to both houses, both chambers, to pass a second time. But the alternative to that is that if the House of Representatives were to just pass exactly what the Senate passed, it does not have to go through conference committee. And so they might end up in that situation where the House is willing to just say like, great, we'll do whatever you say, Senate, and they'll just pass that. If that's the case, then they don't need a conference committee. And my sense is that what's going on right now behind the scenes to expedite this process is that, you know, House members and especially the leadership are working with the Senate to try and get things into the plan now rather than have to do that conference committee. So I think it is likely that we might not have to go to conference committee on this on the budget reconciliation.
Thank you for that. And I think this is the million-dollar question. We'll save it for last. Vivian just asked it. What's CCL's plan if a carbon price is included in reconciliation?
Well, so we have a big rollout plan for if it's once we see that it's officially in the draft legislation. And the first step in that rollout plan, it's not a lot of secrets here because, you know, the press is already talking about this, but basically we're going to have an all-supporter call so that we can get on the same page in terms of messaging, in terms of the actions that we're going to take to celebrate that victory it's a great step to get to that place. And to be clear on like what our next steps are. Now, we're sort of already in that process. Like, you know, we were sort of because, you know, news has already been leaking, you know, people are already talking about it. Everyone knows now that the Senate Finance Committee is considering this. And so a lot of the actions that we're going to take upon that event, we're already taking them. We're writing the president, we're writing, you know, senators, you know, we've been providing you with messaging. You should all be writing LTEs. You're reaching out to your grass tops. So there is going to be somewhat of a, like, you know, like, I don't think you're going to see a lot of surprises, you know, at that moment. You're going to see a lot of, this is awesome. Let's make sure the world knows about it. Let's make sure the Senate and, you know, the president know that we support this. You know, go talk to your other organizations and your allies to make sure that they're on board and get them on board with carbon pricing as part of the reconciliation package. So, but we will make sure that, you know, that we get a deep analysis of all, you know, what, you know, because we don't know the details of the carbon pricing yet. Once we have that, we're going to analyze it. We're going to give you talking points. We're going to make sure that you know everything you need to know to be able to advocate for it, like, at this point. And then I'll just say one more thing, Brett, you know, because in terms of time frame, we really do not know how long it's going to take before we see draft legislation. It was supposed to be from the Senate yesterday, but it didn't come out. Our best guess right now is it might be another week or two. And then similarly, we don't know how long this process is going to take. There are people on Twitter making bets on, will it be before Thanksgiving or not until Christmas or not until the new year? So, like, we could be in this process for months at this point. So keep your hopes up and also be ready. We're in the home stretch, but we really don't know exactly where the finish line is yet. So, and they might keep moving it. So it's a really tricky situation to be in. But with that, I'll turn it back over to Brett.
A reminder that all of the resources that Tony's mentioned, all of the key other explainers out there on budget reconciliation are available on this one link that I just put in the chat as well, where all of our reconciliation information is at. You can just type reconciliation into CCL Community. It's the top hit. If you're looking for ways to influence, we're giving a quick shout out to our phone and text banking campaign too. Just type in phone banking. Tony's also on top of everything else, help launch and facilitate those. I can personally attest to how fulfilling those are. So check it out if you want to make a difference on that front with some actions as well as theory. And if you have questions after tonight, you can always go to our forums and ask away. Our staff are going to be sure to get back to you. And we just really want to close tonight by thanking each of you for your time, for your leadership in this critical window. This is truly an all hands on deck moment, and we are finally seeing light at the end of the tunnel here. So I'm at least personally really excited, and especially with webinars like tonight, they just really ground me in how close we are to finally realizing this goal that we've all been advocating for a long time. So thank you again so much, Tony, for joining us tonight. I'm gonna unmute all lines and stay safe out there, everyone.
Tony, thanks, Brett. Thanks everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.